Why has American politics fallen into such a state of horrible dysfunction? Can it ever be fixed? These are the questions that motivate the new book, If We Can Keep It, by Michael Tomasky. Michael Tomasky is a columnist for The Daily Beast, a contributing opinion writer for The New York Times, and a regular contributor to The New York Review of Books. Again, the name of his new book is If We Can Keep It, How the Republic Collapsed and How It Might Be Saved. And we welcome Michael Tomasky to the roundtable this morning. Michael, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Joe. It's my pleasure.
What brought you to the subject of this idea of the Republic?
Well, if you do what I do for a living and write about politics, you sort of can't help but think about this stuff every day of your life, every hour of every day, practically. So, this is a book that has been bubbling around in my brain for a few years. And actually, before Donald Trump was elected, but his election, I think, I would argue, makes it all the more exigent and necessary. And, here we are. We're at a tough, perilous time when everything seems broken and it seems pretty hopeless.
So how much of that is true? How much of it is indeed broken, do you think?
Oh, I think it's quite true. Now, one of the points I make in the book is that there's an extent to which this has always been the case in the United States, and I go back through that history in the first two or three chapters are devoted to talking about that history. Our divisions are real, and they've existed since the very beginning, since they debated the Constitution in Philadelphia in 1787, and a lot of those discussions that we were taught as school kids, were written practically with the hand of God and were this brilliant development in the history of humankind. It was that in a certain way, but they were also very hard-fought compromises. And they took a lot of tough votes at that Constitutional Convention and reached a lot of conclusions that didn't particularly please anybody. But there was politics, and they knew they had to compromise, and they moved on. Anyway, fast forward, throughout the 19th century into the 20th, very divided over a number of issues, slavery being the most notable, but, the size and scope of the federal government, which is still the fundamental thing we're most deeply divided about today. And so I trace all that history, and then I go into the 20th century, where during the Depression and the war and after that, we had a period of relative consensus. And then from the 60s forward, we've gone back to dysfunction again, and it's probably worse today than at any point, maybe except the 1850s.
The idea, though, as you go through this history and look at the times, various times in our history, of polarization and dysfunction, and yet there was always kind of a track that was followed that we kind of bumbled our way out of that. And I guess it's to what you were just saying, by the sixth chapter of this book, when you're talking about what we consider to be really the beginning of our current political woes Clinton versus Gingrich, then everything just kind of, we gave up, right? I mean, we just sort of like, okay, well, this is what it is now.
Yeah, well, we gave up, but it's also, the country changed in a lot of ways and politics changed in a lot of ways. That just made compromise tougher. And one of the big things is that if you go back through the history of the country, we almost always had a two-party system, but we never really had ideologically coherent parties. We think of the Democrats historically as the liberal party. That didn't really happen until Franklin Roosevelt. The Democratic Party of the 19th century was a party of two completely different things: Southern segregationist racists who imposed Jim Crow, and in the North, the Democratic Party was largely a party of immigrants and urban machines. It was the party of Boss Tweed, if you want to put it that way. So they didn't have any ideological coherence to them. Same thing with the Republicans. They had some ideological coherence while Lincoln was alive, but then after the Civil War and into the Industrial Revolution, the Republican Party contained both Wall Street, rich people, and prairie agrarian populists from out in, Wisconsin and Minnesota and other new states to the west that were being created in those days. So we had parties that were competitive with each other, but they weren't ideologically consistent or coherent parties. That started to happen in the 1960s over race and civil rights, and then over gender politics, over abortion, over other new issues that arose, immigration at that time. And so that's really fundamentally what locked us into this situation where the two parties are ideologically warring camps. It's an unusual and new, historically speaking, development for the United States.
All of this in the book brings us to the last third, really, which is if we can keep it, and it's a 14-point agenda to reduce polarization. Before we start going through some of this and talk to you in detail, I'm interested in your degree of optimism going in as to how doable this agenda is.
I'm not overly optimistic, and I think I'm upfront with my readers about that. I say, well, look, here are my ideas, but to be honest with you, none of them's going to be implemented this year or next year or within the next 3 or 4 years. This is a problem that, we've spent a long time, creating, and it's going to take a long time to get out of it. So, we're not going to, there's no magic bullet. There's no idea that 5 years from now we'll be getting along. Maybe 20 years from now we'll be getting along somewhat better.
When you look at this agenda, there is one thing, as I said, I'm going to skip around a little bit, but one of the things that you write about is getting rid of the Electoral College system, or at very least make it obey the popular vote. Why is that not a more popular sentiment, do you think, than it is?
Yeah, well, I think it's pretty popular among Democrats and pretty unpopular among Republicans, and I can see why in both cases, right? Because two of the last, whatever, how many, five or so presidential elections have been won by Republicans who lost the popular vote. So Republicans are pretty happy with the Electoral College. It put George W. Bush and Donald Trump in office, or the Supreme Court put Bush in office. But, I mean, he held his own in the Electoral College, even though losing the popular vote. And Democrats, of course, don't like that. Now, a number of states have passed this legislation that would say we're going to make it so that our electoral votes will be awarded to the person who won the popular vote in this state. That way, somebody who won a majority of votes would presumably be the president of the United States. I think somewhere in the teens have passed it. But, there's a lot of resistance to it. But I don't know, some surprising states have passed it. It's not just blue states. A few purple states have passed it. So there may be some hope there.
The importance you put in reviving moderate republicanism, what is that, and how do you see that ultimately happening?
Well, it has to happen through because somebody making it happen, and a lot of somebodies, and somebody, some rich people pouring money into the project of reviving moderate republicanism. When I was a kid, there were genuine moderate Republicans. There were even liberal Republicans like Jacob Javits of New York, who was one of the prime, liberal Republicans of his time. That's never going to happen. There aren't going to be Republicans like that. The two parties are too divided. People like Jacob Javits have become Democrats now. But what I mean is this. Right now, Republicans come to Congress, and this is true to some extent of Democrats too, but it's truer of Republicans. They come to Congress from these very gerrymandered districts, and they have no pressure to compromise at all. The only pressure that's on them is against compromising. Because if they vote for, you know, say when Obama was president, if they voted for an Obama judge or Obama's budget or something like that, boom, they'd have a primary from somebody to their right who could raise money, and it would be well-financed. They'd get national conservative money, and they'd campaign saying so-and-so is a sellout. And indeed, a number of Republican incumbents lost primaries that way in those days. So what is needed is a countervailing force to that. And again, that's something that will have to be built slowly over time. But it can happen. I mean, this existing force on the right was built slowly and over time because people put money into it and were patient and developed a machinery that could threaten these people and make them not compromise. The other machinery can be built, too. And I think that would change our politics a lot. It's a lot more realistic than somebody thinking that he can run for president as an independent and change things. That won't change anything.
I want to read just a bit that you write in the final chapter. It's about 20 pages before the end of the book. You say everything that's been written so far could have been written without changing a word if Hillary Clinton were president, or Ted Cruz, or Jeb Bush. If Clinton were in the White House, the reality I anticipated when I started thinking about this book, the Republicans would have been on the warpath. There would have been hearings on the emails and still another investigation, which would have been the eighth, into the Benghazi deaths of four Americans in 2012. And if one of the other Republicans had made it, Congress would be just as dysfunctional and the parties just as divided as they are now. But they're not president. Donald Trump is, and things are different. Trump has done two things that mark him as a graver threat to the Republic than any other president since at least Richard Nixon. Tell us about that.
The main one is his attitude toward the Constitution. And, it's very serious, and he doesn't care anything about the Constitution. He cares about winning. The other thing is his racial arson that he's just he can only succeed by dividing people. He can only succeed by dividing people, and that's very worrisome and practically unprecedented. I mean, I might argue that Andrew Johnson was kind of like that, the president who took over after Lincoln was assassinated. He thrived on division, created division. Some of the steps he took to bring the union back together. And Trump is that same kind of politician. And, these things are only going to get worse as long as he's in there and tweeting and calling people names and firing people at whim and all the rest of it.
Going back, and let's end on this point, but going back to what you were saying, I mean, none of this is going to happen quickly, and it may not be easy, but you're optimistic at least that they're most probably in this next election will be, you think there will be some push to do something?
Yeah, I guess there'll be some push to do something. I mean, I don't know, though. I mean, in the short term, I'm not very optimistic, but in the long term, I think we can change. I think there's a critical mass of people who do want things to be better. But a big part of this, too, Joe, is economic. Mm. As long as we have these great economic divisions in this country and vast, vast stretches of the United States falling behind and not doing well economically and, you know, not seeing opportunity for young people who are raised there and all the rest of that. As long as that's the case, it's going to be bad. These tensions are going to be bad. These other tensions are going to grow and fester, and it's easy to find scapegoats for politicians to identify scapegoats for people. If, however, there is more general prosperity and the economy is working for more people, the temperature gets lowered on some of these other problems.
The name of the book is If We Can Keep It, How the Republic Collapsed and How It Might Be Saved. The book is published by Liverite. Michael Tomasky, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Pleasure's mine. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is If We Can Keep It by Michael Tomasky. The book is published by Liverite. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.